flat right in front of us. Back wheel, back wheel. You could have heard that. Furiously swapping out. That is a drill you hear, taking the through axles out.
He's in the front. And Johnny and Jasper just behind.
Fucking big crowd, man.
Big push. And he's off. That was only about 30 seconds. Not too bad for a through axle wheel change. And just sealant everywhere. Sealant absolutely everywhere. Welcome back to a special episode of Geek Warning. The audio you just heard was taken or recorded at the exit of the Arenberg Forest at Paris-Roubaix on Sunday, the men's race. Ronan, you and I were standing at the exit of the Arenberg, watching all of the chaos unfold. You also took quite a extensive tour around the pits that morning. So, as you can probably guess, the purpose of this episode is to do a deep, deep dive into some of the classics tech that you dug up, we dug up, mostly you, last week in Belgium and Northern France. So, welcome to the pod, Ronan.
Thank you. Yeah, good, 10 days we were in Belgium and France, at Flanders first and then Roubaix, and yeah, plenty of sort of cobbled classics specific tech that we uncovered over the last 2 weeks. Plenty of galleries up on the website now if anybody hasn't seen them, worth checking out, and more still landing on almost daily basis. So I think we kind of thought that a podcast to discuss some of that might be worthwhile, and especially sort of discussing some of the trends that we seem to have spotted this year in the cobble classics. And I sort of stumbled on my words there, but because previously, especially at Roubaix, of course, the big thing was tire pressure, but also different bikes and suspension systems and quasi suspension and all that sort of thing that just seemed to be almost entirely missing this year, or conspicuous by its absence. So I think we're going to delve into a couple of topics like that on this podcast. And
yeah, let's kick off with kind of the biggest topic, which is exactly what you were just mentioning, which is there was no like funky suspension. There was no, there wasn't even that much like double wrap bar tape, a lot less than in previous years. You know, Trek Segafredo, the men's team, are running Madones, which is their aero bike, obviously not the most comfortable bike in that range. This is a pretty huge departure from what we were seeing like even last year or 2 years ago. It's essentially a change that is accelerating really fast. And I'm curious, you know, when you speak with mechanics, when you chat with riders and technical staff, like what is the reasoning behind the way things are going?
Yeah, well, I suppose good place to start is with Trek, because the women's squad there, they were on the new Domane, which I think originally came about, a decade ago or so now, and was a bike specifically designed, it was an endurance bike, but it was marketed heavily as a bike specifically designed for Roubaix, and has, you know, enjoyed quite a bit of success in Roubaix down through the years, and of course won the first two editions of Paris-Roubaix Femme. And the women's team were still using that new Domane this year, but as early as Wednesday, when we joined the women's team for their recon ride, the Trek staff were already telling us, look, the men will not use the Domani, they will use the new Madone for Roubaix on Sunday, specifically because they reckon that the speeds now are so high in Roubaix, and this year was the fastest on record, which beats last year's race, which was previously the fastest on record, that the
by a whole kilometer per hour, which is wild. Like, was it 46 something now?
It's wild, especially considering how shocked we were about how fast last year's was. Like, last year's race was on from the start. There was that huge split that I think Vanderpool and a few others had missed, and this year was on from the start for different reasons. There just was no split, no breakaway. But anyway, the point still stands that they anticipated that it was going to be a very, very fast race, and at those speeds they reckon the aero benefit from the aero specific bike is more beneficial than the compliance or comfort or whatever they're getting from the endurance or more comfort orientated bike.
Which kind of brings up a much larger topic. It's actually what we were chatting about right before we hit record, which is that the bikes, as they get more, I shouldn't say the bikes, the bits on the bikes, the tires mostly, as they get more, competent in tackling the really nasty cobblestones of Paris-Roubaix, the whole bike itself sort of becomes much more able to tackle that particular challenge. And it actually, this is going to sound crazy, it makes the race in some ways easier, right? Or at the very least, it makes it play out slightly differently, to the point where, you know, when we were talking with teams last week, they were saying that the emphasis on the particularly bad sectors, so mostly the sort of Arenberg and Carrefour, has gone up, because those sectors that were in the middle, those 2 or 3 star sectors, they just aren't enough to make a difference anymore, because the tires are so much more capable of handling cobblestones. And that's not really all that surprising for anybody who has ridden Roubaix on a number of different setups over the years. I count myself as one of those people, which is I've ridden it on 25s, which was dumb, and 28s, which was terrible, and more recently on 30s and 32s. And it is a hugely dramatic difference in sort of the way that you're able to ride the cobbles, and also essentially the difference that they make between riders. So it elevates the importance of some of these really nasty sectors. It decreases the importance of some of the sort of middling sectors. And the other sort of result of it is that you end up looking to other places to find your marginal gains, which is why, you know, you've got Trek running Madones in the men's race. One, because they've got 160K of pavement before they hit the cobbles. And two, because even once they hit the cobbles, they're not slowing down as much as they used to. And a lot of them are essentially ridden like they were pavement these days, which is wild.
Yeah. I think that was first evident to me, what was it, 2 years ago now, the October edition in 2021, when Continental had released their new GP5000 STR right before Roubaix. And at least in my mind, and I could be entirely wrong about this, but at least in my mind, that was like the first time that somewhat lightweight, fast rolling tire that teams were happy to use a week earlier in the Time Trial World Championships were the same tires that teams were rolling out for Roubaix, albeit in different widths. But that was certainly the first time I remember this, basically the same tire being used for a TT World Champion and the winner of Roubaix in the same season. And so while I agree that the modern bikes and modern frames, I probably should say, are getting so much more capable across, you know, and it was effectively standard frames that took first, second, and third on the podium in both races over the weekend. I still think that there's, and I can't believe I'm about to say this, maybe that's why I lost my train of thought for a second. I think that there's maybe an overemphasis on aero here, and the teams are perhaps leaving a bit in terms of just reducing the fatigue on the rider by neglecting these sort of comfier setups, for lack of a better term. And my reason for thinking that is just, if you took the Roubaix course, took all the cobbles out of it, 260K from Compiègne to Roubaix, tarmac to Hoey, it's a guaranteed bunch sprint every single time. But because these cobble sectors are added in, we're still seeing every single year literally ones and twos coming into the finish line, minutes between them, the best riders in the world on their absolute hands and knees. And that tells me that comfort and compliance and just reducing the amount of fatigue the rider is suffering is still the number one player. Add in all the extra elements like the variability of riding across the cobbles, the, you know, just all the chaos that ensues there. And I just don't know how much of a benefit aero could be once you get into the final, you know, once you had that first sector of cobbles. From that point onwards, I don't know how much of a benefit aero could be. And I would be very surprised if the aero benefits of the first 160K outweigh what they're losing in the second 100-odd K of the race. So I've no data to back that up. That's just my sort of gut feeling. I kind of feel the same about sort of tire pressures and tire widths and that the teams are choosing, especially those running narrower tubs. And there's a whole host of reasons we can go into for why they might choose tubs over tubeless. But the more I see the bikes of Roubaix looking exactly like the bikes you're using every other weekend of the year, the more I think there's maybe quite a bit left on the table here. And if you know if we're looking for any sort of evidence of that, and perhaps adding more confusion into the subject, but anyway, I'll say it anyway, is Jumbo-Visma, who have the S5 that they ride for the majority of the year. They have the R5 for hellier stages, and then they have the Caledonia that they've typically used for Roubaix over the last couple of seasons, and then this year they're using the Soloist. And yeah, there's just so much going on there. It's like they've the official reason I think they're choosing the Soloist is because it's got better tire clearance, but the entire team were riding 30mm tubeless tires, and the S5 is more than capable of taking 33mm tires. So to me, there's something in the maybe the stiffness or something from the S5 that has them then moving towards the Soloist. But I think if you're going to make that step, then you know the difference between the Soloist and the Caledonia in terms of aero, I can't imagine it's going to be massive. Like the Caledonia has the basics done right in terms of aero, so could be rider preference in terms of geometry or setup or something. But yeah, it's very different Roubaix than we've seen even 10 years ago, or even more recently than that.
Our friends over at Pink Bike, they did a project a couple years ago called the Grim Donut, where they basically took mountain bike geometry for like the last 10 years, and they just extrapolated, right? So, you know, head tube angles went from 69 to 68 down to like, I mean, most even cross country mountain bikes these days are in the sort of like 66, 65. Trail bikes are in 64s, 63s even. Anyway, they extrapolated that out like another 10 years, I think it was, and they built that bike. And so it had this crazy long top tube and crazy slack front end. And it was just a ridiculous machine that also turned out to be incredibly fast, was part of the fun of this project. Which brings me to, if you did the same thing with essentially tire widths at Roubaix, in the span of 10 years, we've gone from sort of 25s, 28s. I mean, when I first started covering Roubaix, in fact, I should go back and look at some of the early galleries I did as a tech editor at Velo News in like 2011, 2012. There were still 25mm tires in the start paddock, which feels insane now. And now we're up to, you know, 32s that if you measure them, a lot of them are probably actually blowing up to, you know, even larger than a 32 by a bit. If you extrapolate that out, you end up with like, okay, well, another 10 years, we're going to be riding 40mm tires at Roubaix, right? Is that something that you think is feasible, possible? Knowing what we know about rolling resistance and the fact that you could build a 40mm tire that rolls about as fast as a 32, and particularly as that technology continues to improve, I think that's a reasonable assumption. Aero is going to be less. It's going to feel slower, which is, I think, part of the thing that needs to be overcome all the time, is the riders needs to feel fast, and actually bumpy feels fast. So what do you think? Where do we end up here?
I think it was as recently as 2018 or 2019 that Alexander Kristoff was like the only rider in Roubaix who had chosen tubeless tires, but had for some reason done so with 25mm tubeless setup, and punctured a bajillion times in the race and swore he would never ride tubeless again. And at the time, everybody feared, well, that's it. We're never going to see tubeless used again at Roubaix. The problem there was the width. You know, he had used 25s. Now, when we were walking around the paddock on Saturday and Sunday mornings, 28 looked incredibly narrow. There was only a few 28s about. I would say the vast majority of the women's peloton were on 30s, and for some reason, tubular tires. The reason I was given for that was that at the lower pressures that some of the women were choosing, the tubeless tires were causing a sort of bouncing effect, and actually burping a bit, so they're even losing more pressure across the cobbles. And for that reason, the riders preferred tubular. fast forward to Sunday morning, and you know, bigger riders, heavier riders, the men seem to be choosing almost entirely on 30s and 32s and tubeless. Only one team, Flanders Balois, whatever they're called nowadays, were on 28 mil tubs. And you know, the natural progression might seem like we get wider and wider and wider. I'm not sure where the tipping point is. That is it 32, is it 34, is it 35, that beyond that the rolling resistance starts to dramatically increase. But I think on the roads that we're racing on here, and even the roads a weekend earlier in Flanders, which obviously the cobbles are not as bad, but the roads between the cobble climbs in Flanders are much, much worse than the roads between the cobble sectors in Roubaix. So I think there's probably a lot of riders who were not on 32s who could have been. Yes, it does feel slower, but I think that's the biggest barrier right now is just the feel of how it rolls. Everything that I understand, or everything that, and I haven't actually tested this on the Roubaix cobbles, so perhaps the teams have, but my gut instinct would be these tires are, you know, so light and so fast nowadays anyway, that you can go right up to 32s without really a significant increase in rolling resistance, and potentially actually a decrease in rolling resistance on these roads. But beyond that, right now, the limitation, especially on the front wheel, is rim width, because you do want to sort of match the tire width to the rim width for an optimal aerodynamic setup. So, you know, you see a lot of the teams there, even Jumbo-Visma, for example, they're riding those new reserve wheels. I can't remember the exact external measurement on that rim off the top of my head. I think it might be 33 mil. And with a 32 mil tire, really, if you think of CDA, the CD part is staying the same. It's as aero as it was. It's just the A part that increases. So you're not really paying that much of an aero penalty by putting a big tire in the front. But other wheel manufacturers who maybe are still making narrower external rim widths, those teams using those wheels are maybe stuck on 30s right now. But if those rim widths increase in the future, we could see even, you know, I think the point I'm trying to get to is that if everything else was equal, I wouldn't be surprised if we seen 34s in the near future or something around that mark.
Which is crazy.
Well, is it crazy though? Well, it's like, yeah.
I guess, I mean, yes and no, but that's officially like, that's bigger than you can run in a cross race, right? Like that's bigger than the maximum tire size in a cyclocross race. And it's a road race still. Like even if it's Roubaix, it's still a road race. And I actually brought this up in our Sunday evening episode of Placeholders, which was like, at some point does the UCI come in and put a cap on tire size? And it feels like they might. I don't know. Maybe a question for Mick Rogers that weekend. Next time we corner him, we can chuck that one his way.
Which I should say we did do at Flanders, I think we're getting a bit bogged down in tire widths and that here. So I might move it on a little bit, but there's been a lot of talk about, you know, an increase in failure rates at Roubaix this year. And if I remember right, we had the exact same conversations last year. And, you know, some of the criticism tubeless systems have been coming in for at this Roubaix is, you know, that they actually quite a few crashes seem to have been either caused by or partially caused by a puncture, which then led to a failure of some sort, which then led to a crash.
James was positing that there was maybe like the tire may have never actually punctured, but if you crack a rim, that's effectively that's the other way for the air to escape, right? And so you can actually have a crash caused by never having a puncture other than puncturing the rim, basically, instead of puncturing the tire, which I mean certainly seems like a reasonable hypothesis to me.
And that's what I was going to get to, is that there at least was it Geraint Thomas podcast this week, they were discussing the same thing. I haven't actually heard it myself, but someone had mentioned to me that Geraint Thomas and Luke Rowe were discussing this, and that Ineos Grenadiers choose to ride with inserts, tire liners. Should they puncture then, the on the cobbles, the tubeless tire has a better chance of staying seated. And I think that's their reckoning was that they choose inserts, but that does come with a 3-watt penalty. And other teams may not be doing that because they don't want the 3-watt penalty of running these inserts. And I'm sort of, what struck me, and I'm trying to find the right way of saying this, but what struck me and throughout this whole tire conversation over the past two weekends was, as forward thinking as the teams are now, there's still that element of tradition that sort of it seems to be holding some teams back. Like 3-watt penalty for running an insert, fair play to any of us, they're looking past that because the benefit of being able to ride at lower pressures far outweighs that. You know, you could be talking 10 watts if you're at the at a suitable pressure, so you've 7-watt net gain there. And then you look around and other teams are maybe going to tubeless and not running inserts to save those few watts. And then there's teams looking at tubeless and saying, well, if we need to run inserts, we may as well not bother going tubeless and ride tubular. And you know, a modern tubular, God knows how much slower in terms of watts that is than an optimal tubeless setup. Then we've got AG2R, who at Flanders were running a tubeless front and a tubular rear, which so you know, it just struck me.
I really like that vibe.
It was kind of like a heart back to the good old days where you had just some random combinations for Roubaix, and I can't think of any off the top of my head, but you would have had just random stuff that you never would see throughout the rest of the year pop up for a Roubaix weekend. But yeah, it just. I still think that the Peloton is, and you know, these are some of the best riders in the world, so who am I to say that they're doing it wrong or whatever, but the rider is still very much in charge of the final say on setup in a lot of teams, and they're not always looking at the data. They're more often than not going on feel, and having spent the last few weeks sort of trying out 28, 30, 32 mil tires across a range of pressures, across different wheels, across different inner and outer rim widths, I can say that I haven't got the data to back it up, but I would be more than confident in saying, especially for the rougher roads that I have around here, which are quite similar to the terrible roads that we had in Flanders 2 weeks ago, running softer, you get home from a ride, average speed, average power, you know, not very scientific, but there's no noticeable difference in that. But in terms of comfort on the bike, it is huge. And it's most noticeable that going from a 28 tire around 70, 80 PSI down to a 32 at around 50 PSI for the first like 3 days, every time you get on, it's like, whoa, this is noticeably nicer to ride. It's just so much better. And then after about 3 days, there's just that feeling goes away. You just get used to it. And I just wonder how much that initial feeling of it feels comfier, but that does feel slower. As we all know, rough and tumble, for whatever reason, feels faster.
So, Ronan, like, what can the average you're kind of just talking about this, but what can the average person take out of what these pro teams are figuring out around Roubaix? Now, granted, we're not riding the Roubaix cobblestones all the time, but I mean, there's definite takeaways here, which is that, you know, you can win one of the biggest bike races in the world with a 30 plus mil tire, right? So what does that mean for kind of the rest of us?
It kind of, and I'm maybe a little biased in this entire conversation because I have been experimenting a lot recently with forgoing a little bit of frame aerodynamics, let's say, in return for a bigger picture marginal gain. So yes, you want to optimize aerodynamics as much as you can, but the riders are all using aero helmets, race suits, overshoes. Well, not overshoes actually, but they're dialed in terms of aero almost everywhere nowadays. And what I've been sort of looking at recently is just, you know, I have a Domana here I've been experimenting with, but just how much marginal gains are still left on the table looking at rider comfort. And it's a area that's pretty much impossible to measure, but I'm more and more convinced that actually getting to the finish fresher, given where endurance bikes are at now, getting to the finish fresher could be the sort of next opportunity that the marketeers jump onto, and I genuinely think for good reason, even down to, you know, we've looked at pros for, or we've watched pros for a year with slam stems and, you know, really low setups in the front end, and actually, are you more aero if you've got a higher front end and you can sit down into it? Are you maybe giving up a little bit in aero but gaining so much in terms of comfort that you're again coming to the finish line fresher? Are you maybe not feeling as fast because you're running wider tires at lower pressures, but actually you are just as fast, lower rolling resistance from lower pressures and wider tires, and all that combined, you know, could we be, you know, not only more comfortable on our bikes, but actually fresher at the end of our rides, and not really giving up that much aero losses, because the endurance bikes nowadays, they've got all the truncated tubing, they've got internal cable routing, they've got, you know, you can use wheels across whatever bike you're using, and you can pull back a bit of that aero by putting on narrower handlebars, making different adjustments there. So yeah,
I'm gonna pull in a bit of experience from somewhere completely different, which is mountain bike racing. And I feel like the mountain bike world is a little bit ahead of the game, as is often the case in some of this stuff. You know, 2.4 tires are now very much the norm in sort of the mountain bike world, and that's a much, much, much larger tire than you would find even sort of, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago. And from a sort of specific race, like if you take Leadville, for example, which is a, you know, it's a roadies mountain bike race, right? But even so, there's a fair number of sort of like long descents where the ability to sit down in the saddle and recover and all the rest makes a huge difference. And like personally, I've done that race a couple different times and have done it faster on a full suspension bike, even though it's like 3-4 pounds heavier every single time. And it's, you know, feels slower on the long road sections, and it feels slower in lots of important key parts. But overall, it ends up being faster because I end up, you know, getting to the finish line slightly less worked over than I would otherwise. And I think I think you're right, Ronan, in that I think that mindset is going to be something that increasingly comes into road racing, in particular at these really long classics. I mean, you know, a 260-270K day is a lot different from a 200K day. And so that's why these big monuments are maybe going to be treated slightly differently. But it does feel kind of like the next frontier in marginal gains is okay, we've got a pretty good idea regarding rolling resistance. We've got very, you know, dialed in theories around aerodynamics. What's the next one? Well, you know, it's not getting worked over by the bike, basically, and therefore getting the finish line a little fresher.
Yeah, I think that's the other big limitation right now. You mentioned there is just weight, and there's still so much of a focus on weight within the pro peloton. I don't know if it's true or not, but I read somewhere over the weekend, I think it was Road CC, had a quote from Mads Pedersen that he didn't run double bar tape because it was a waste of extra weight, which, you know, I'm going to go ahead and say that whatever a roll of bar tape weighs, which I have checked it before when I was doing the whole Everson thing, I think it's about 21 grams per side, makes no difference at Roubaix, but that's still how much weight that pro riders do put into how much their bike weighs. And, you know, and whatever an extra kilo would make from the heaviest to the lightest bike in the heaviest bike in Roubaix to maybe the lightest bike that you could use in the climbing stage of the tour, 40 odd grams is going to make absolutely zero difference. And, you know, then extrapolate that to percentage of body weight, and it's even tinier again, like, or even total system weight, body and rider combined, or body and bike combined. But the other big thing that I think we haven't mentioned here is just the extra, you know, in terms of the rider at home and myself, what I've experienced is the extra grip that you have from wider, softer tires on the road. You know, that's when you see the likes of Van der Poel's descent off the Poggio, you know, the 32 mil tires, and, you know, I'm not sure how much effect that would have had over the entire course of Milan-San Remo. I think everybody's instinct would be to say that it would be a slower tire for Milan San Remo. If it's wider, I'm not as convinced of that as I used to be. But what I am convinced is that it would have been so much faster in both the descent of the Cipressa and the Poggio. Had that been any way closer, you could, you know, ultimately it made no difference, but had it been closer, you could argue that actually, you know, scenarios like that are where going even wider as a norm across all races could be an all-around benefit.
I want to move on from directly talking about tires and talking about inflating them and deflating them and then inflating them again if you really want to. Let's talk about tire pressure management systems, which were a frequent topic of discussion last week. Jumbo-Visma did end up riding some of these things. Wout van Aert didn't, but I think Christophe Laporte did. In fact, we watched him get a rear wheel change right in front of us and took that tire pressure management wheel off. What's the deal with these? There are some updates to them to make them slightly better for Roubaix. Do you see their use increasing over the next couple of years?
You're asking me like I'm some kind of expert or something, but I kind of had to keep reminding myself over the past 2 weeks that this is still sort of new news, because the Grava cap system that Jumbo-Visma are using in Roubaix, and it was Eduardo Affini, Dylan van Baarle, who was last year's Paris-Roubaix winner, and Christophe Laporte, who were the three. There was a fourth rider as well, I can't remember who now, from Jumbo-Visma, who used the tire pressure management system. So these were not, you know, small name domestic riders who were only riding the first 100K and it was a marketing ploy or whatever. You know, genuinely, Christophe Laporte was one of the favourites for the race and was willing to choose this. But it's 2 years ago at Eurobike 2021 that we first seen Grava system. And then you had Team DSM who were using the Scope Atmos that they had teased this time last year before Roubaix. And then Scope had sort of showed it off at Eurobike 2022. So these are systems that we had sort of already seen quite a bit. But actually, this is the first time that they were used in competition, and both DSM and Jumbo-Visma used them on Sunday. And I don't know, I go back and forth whether or not we'll see these used more often. I think for Roubaix, as the technology improves, we will definitely see these more prevalent, especially with teams like DSM, who it was effectively Team DSM who developed this Atmos system with Scope. So, and they developed specifically for Paris-Roubaix. So presumably, as costs come down, as they can manufacture more of them, the team will use more of these going forward. The system that Jumbo-Visma is using is from a Dutch company also called Grava, and they developed their CAPS tire pressure management system off the back of the founder of that company who had watched as, I think the story goes that he was doing a beach race in the Netherlands, had 15 kilometers of tarmac between beach sections, and had watched the race disappear up the road away from as he stopped to adjust his tire pressure, and he thought there must be a better way. So that was actually developed for an entirely different use. They, Grava specifically, see beach racing and gravel racing as the key market for their cap system. But obviously, again, Roubaix presents a big opportunity, and they partnered with Jumbo-Visma. That, you know, must be, we're here talking about it, so pretty much as marketing gold. We might not be talking about that system otherwise. I guess the question remains, will we see it in use throughout the rest of the road season? I think it comes back to everything we just talked about in terms of tradition dictating within pro cycling. It does, both systems add about 500 grams to the weight of the bike, which again really is nothing in the grand scheme of things, but you don't want to add an extra kilo if you don't have to. And then just the big question of what is the benefit in other races throughout the year. And I'm probably not the best person to ask, because I'm a tech fan and I probably would at least try it. I see, like, again, Flanders, I see, and any of the Cobble Classics for that matter, I see plenty of potential. And I think I'm leaning more towards the Grava cap system at the moment. And for the simple reason that it's almost limitless how much you can use it within a ride, whereas the Scope Atmos, you can only really use it 6 to 8 times. So for that reason, I'm leaning towards the cap system right now, but I haven't actually tried either for any amount of time. So for the cobble classics, yes, for obvious reasons, changing tire pressures between tarmac and cobbles. But again, coming back to extra grip, like if we could get modern bikes down to 6.8 kilo weight limit, which we're sort of moving further and further away from, it seems. But if we were at a point where 6.8 was the norm again, and you had the option of adding in 500 grams without tipping over 8 kilos or whatever, you know, suddenly you could be looking at, again, Milan-San Remo, perfect option. If you could ride at a harder pressure for the first 290 kilometers of Milan-San Remo, and once you get to the top of the Poggio, drop your tire pressure by a bar and a half, and rail the descent again. You know, there's I really do think that grip and just general tire technology is again one of the sort of new frontiers that we're seeing many brands sort of push into. And you know, if you think, again, if you give Vanderpool an extra 20% grip on that descent, you know, he already won the race. So let's say if you give Wout van Aert or Philippe Ogana, who struggled a bit on the descent, if you give Philippe Ogana an extra 20% grip on that descent, does he then close the gap to Van der Poel? You know, so an extra 500 grams, when you consider Ganna is maybe 80 kilos and his bike is 7.5-8 kilos, you know, an extra 500 grams is nothing. So yeah. could see more of it in future, but probably won't.
And the systems might get lighter too. You never know, right? Like, I mean, I'm assuming that they
probably need to get cheaper quickly. Also, at yeah. $4,000 a piece right now, they're not cheap. The big problem that nobody is really discussing is, what do you do if you want the classified internal gear system and a tire pressure management system in your hub, and you've only got one hub? those are the problems we're going to face in future.
Wild times. What about one by for Roubaix? We saw quite a bit of it, but not sort of ubiquitous. Like, that's not everywhere, but more and more every year.
Yeah, I think it's probably not the first, but again, it's like so many examples in pro cycling. When somebody wins with something, then it's much quicker adopted. And we've seen Lizzie Deignan and then Lisa Longo Borghini win the first two editions of Paris-Roubaix Femme with one-by setups from SRAM. And then all of a sudden, last year we already seen a few more one-by setups in the men's peloton. And this year it probably wasn't quite 50% of the peloton one-by, but it wasn't far behind. Like, there was entire teams, like Uno X, where the entire squad was running one-by chain rings from the British brand Pyramid Cycle Design. Most of the team were riding 56 one-bys. Alexander Kristoff was on a 54. You had Anthony Turgis running a drag to zero, 56 tooth one-by chain ring over at Total Energies. Pretty much every SRAM rider in the race was on a one-by setup, and most of them were running 54s. And the reasons are sort of, there's an aero benefit because you have no front derailleur and you've only one chainring. But I think the bigger reason is just that the extra chain retention you get from the narrow wide tooth profile is it's a couple of things factored together that are seeing teams now move to one by, but chain retention is definitely a big one on the cobbles.
Would you run one by?
I mean, like, I have previously built the perfect Roubaix bike, and yes, I had one by on it and had a 54 tooth one by SRAM chainring there. So I'm not saying that, you know, that they're also looking to the stuff that I've built in the past and then seeing Deignan and Borghini win on them, but maybe, who knows.
What would your perfect Roubaix bike be now? What would it, like, for racing it, if you were going to be in the actual race, you know, because yeah, previously, in a previous life, in a previous place, you built one that had a Lauf fork on it, like suspension fork on it, which was lovely.
Perfect Roubaix sportif bike. Yeah.
Yeah, that was the perfect Roubaix sportif bike. So what about the perfect Roubaix race bike? Where are we at today? If you could pick from, you know, anybody sponsoring anybody in the World Tour, so any of the bikes that were floating around the paddock Sunday, Saturday morning, what would you build?
I mean, frustratingly at the time, I had emailed Grava maybe 2, 3, 4 times to try and get a gravel wheel set for that bike also to have the tire pressure management system. And just never got a reply, so that didn't happen. But it would have been nice now to be looking back going, yeah, all these guys were running it this year. We had it a year ago, but whatever. I don't think much would change, to be honest. I mean...
Well, describe it. For anybody who missed the previous life and previous story,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, frame first. What frame would you build it around?
So... Last year I had gone with a Trek Domani, and it was the Gen 2, Gen 3? Gen 3, I think. Now we've got the Gen 4 Domani, which, you know, has, if I recall correctly, has a deeper head tube, taller bottom bracket area, slightly more aero, or at least claimed to be more aero. So I probably would, although I'm not even convinced on that because... The ISO speed system that the Domani previously had was one of the main reasons I had chosen that. So yeah, like basically I'd gone for an endurance bike with sort of comfort and compliance features to smooth out the cobbles and then tried to aero everything around it. So gone for narrow handlebars, again, would do that. That's kind of a no-brainer. I'd chosen 40s last year, probably would go much narrower this year, something flared, bearing in mind that you spend most of the time on the cobbles actually on the tops, so that to me is a no-brainer. Add wireless blips in there or satellite shifters if you're using DI2, again, because you're on the tops. And what I learned last week is, if you know, you really do want shifting up there. Actually, if I was going back, I'd probably want cross-top brake levers up there also. And then the big one for me was just aero optimizing, like the wheels and the tire setup. So we'd gone for the Hunt Limitless 48s because off the top of my head, they were like the widest wheels that I had access to at the time. Had last year used 33 mil tires, so wouldn't change that. Probably would include inserts now, having used... inserts since then. I'm definitely a convert. On slightly lower pressure, I should also say that a big part of Roubaix is just having the confidence that you're not going to break your equipment. If you're having to babysit your bike across all the sectors, that consumes a considerable amount of energy, and you're also just not as confident in following closely on the wheel. And when I did the recon with Trek Segafredo last week, I was like, it was effectively the same bike, didn't have the life fork, but it's effectively also now my bike, and I didn't want to break it and I didn't want to damage the wheels, so I was really tentatively picking my line through the cobbles. If you have confidence, if you have a tire insert in there and you know you're not going to break the rim with a strike on the cobbles, then you know you can just wail faster into it without that concern. And then, you know, we already had the one by setup, so probably keep that the same also. I'm not sure a great deal would actually change. I'm also having a bit of a mind blank now. I do know there was some other frame since then that I thought also, oh, that could work, but I can't remember off the top of my head what it is.
What about bars? What would you do with bars? Would you do double wrap bar tape and aero bars with flat tops? What would you do?
I haven't tried them yet, but I would like to try the Aero Coach Arnix, the new handlebars from Aero Coach are like 32 centimeters wide at the hoods and 36 at the drops. And yeah, I probably would run double wrap just for old time's sake. Like Vanderpool had double wrap bar tape on Sunday. And yeah, Vanderpool had 32 mil tires. So wider tires and an extra wrap of bar tape were literally the only differences to the entire Alpecin to Koenig squad, their bikes for Milan San Remo 3 weeks earlier.
That's wild. How times have changed. All right, one of the last things I want to ask you about here, Ronan. This has been really obvious to anybody who's looked at a professional race bike in the last like year or so. I don't know who we have to thank for this. I don't know if it's Dan Bigham or Taco Vanderhorn, or I don't know who gets the blame, but
they might see it as credit. Who gets the credit?
They welcome to, but I see it as blame. What about the inward pointed levers? What I mean, the why is obvious because it's essentially they're trying to get around the ban of the puppy paws, right? And trying to essentially get into like a almost like an arrow bar type position. But also, well, you were experimenting with this, with the sort of angled in levers. What were your conclusions?
Yeah, I started trying it more so because there's a rider local to myself here who races at a decently high level here in Ireland, and he was very, very keen for me to give him a bike fit on, despite me not being a professional bike fitter and not doing bike fits at all. He was very keen for me to do his bike fit on a new bike they'd got for this race season, and he was very keen to go with very narrow handlebars, which I'm totally in agreement with, but he's also very keen on inward angled levers, and I am not. I don't like inward angled levers. I'll get to why in a second. But it kind of just struck me at the time as like, you know, first of all, our philosophies are so different on bike fit. I was like, maybe I'm not the best person to be doing your bike fit. You should probably go to someone else who will give you what you want, because that's also important when it comes to bike fit. But so off the back of that, rather than just hate on it, I thought I better try this out and get a bit of experience for myself. And I am all for narrow handlebars. I really haven't tried everything from 44s right down to 32s. At least for me personally, it's something you very quickly get used to. And after, again, much like we were saying earlier about softer tires and comfier frames, something that after a couple of days you just don't notice anymore. But what I did find was when I angled the levers in, at first it does feel great. I was like, oh, I might have to admit this is actually quite good. And then when you try to ride in a narrow position with your forearms, well, that's in case the UCI is listening, let's say with your forearms on but not on the tops of the handlebars, and you can, you know, especially if you've got your levers angled in and pointed down, you can really quite closely mimic the time trial position, and it presumably is significantly faster, and it's you basically, by having your levers in and down, you take a lot of the pressure off your upper arms, which tend to fatigue if you try to hold that aero position with a normal lever setup. And yeah, at first I was like, actually this is fine, you get used to it. Again, steering wasn't all that affected, but what I never got used to was just trying to accelerate or attack out of the saddle with the levers angled, and I just never really felt like I had the same sort of grip or pull on the handlebars. And I sort of put that down to, well, that's probably just a me thing. All the riders must be fine with it if they're winning bike races with this setup, so whatever. But ultimately I decided I don't like this, because it was only, you know, a week, 2 weeks, maybe, I could have had it for about 3 weeks with the inward levers. I noticed time and time again when I had to react quickly and brake very hard, you know, be that coming to a roundabout and a vehicle comes out of nowhere, or comes out of the other side of the roundabout and I had to react quickly, or for whatever reason, I couldn't react as quickly and get on my brakes as quickly as I would otherwise. And yeah, for that reason, I can't imagine that changes for others all that much. You do load up your hands a little bit more than you do with straighter levers, and the levers are not designed to be used at that, you know, really aggressive inward angle. And as much as I'm all for the aero gains and the tech gains and all that, 99% of the time, this is one time that I really can't get on board with it. You know, the modern lever already has a sort of inward swoop to it, and then you have some riders who go to the absolute extreme, having pointed all the way in, and I just don't believe you can operate your brakes as efficiently as when they're in the position that they're designed to be used in. Couple that with the fact, and perhaps more frustratingly for me, is that so often you see riders with their like levers angled in for the aero gains, but then their elbows pop out, and it's that, you know, you ask anybody, you ask Dan Bigham, or you ask Taco Vanderhorn or Campenarts or Aero Coach or whoever, they will all tell you that narrow bars and inward angle levers only work if you can keep your elbows in also, And if you lengthen your stem so you've got the same reach and you're getting your torso angle down, that's when you get the aero gains. If you just like switch to narrow bars and inward angle levers and then your torso pops up and your elbows pop out, you're probably slower than you were with the older setup. So I don't know. I would not be surprised if we see the UCI do something about the lever. I was about to say I don't know what they could do because it would be very hard to police, but that's never stopped them before. So,
I mean, all you have to do is set a measurement between the back of the hood and the front of the hood that needs to be similar, right? Or within a centimeter or something like that, right?
And then they get ridiculed because they've got some device like the sock height measurement tool that everybody says, "Would you focus on the proper stuff?" To a certain extent, the UCI can't win when it comes to these things.
But we would cheer them on if they did this one, and we usually don't do that.
Usually don't do that.
It's funny, like I spent most of my sort of the last couple of years of my road racing life, which is now a decade ago, with very slightly inwardly tilted mostly SRAM I was riding at that point, like Force and Red back then. And I really liked it because it sort of like just worked with my wrist angle, but it was very much like it was a couple degrees. It wasn't 45 degrees pointed inward. So I'm not opposed to it. Just blanket needs, you know, for aesthetic reasons needs to be pointed perfectly straight. I think that's a silly argument, but it's more about, for me, it's about being able to grab the brakes is kind of an important thing. And it is humorous, I think, that feels like a response to the puppy paws rule, the invisible aero bars rule, and the sort of unintended consequences that things like that can have, right? You never really know. People are going to find ways around the rules that you make, basically.
And yeah, like a big part of the UCI's reasoning at the time of bringing in the puppy paws rule was that kids are trying it at home effectively, you know, not in as many words, but that was certainly part of their reasoning, if I remember correctly. And as you said, here's one of the unintended consequences, and I don't want to see anything banned for the pros because people are trying at home. That to me, you know, the pros are also descending at breakneck speeds down alpine descents, and we don't go trying that at home if we can't do it. So that to me is not a good enough reason to be banning anything. And I'm not even calling for a ban on this. I think it just needs a little bit of, you know, rider policing almost, if we could have such a thing where we all just accept, right, this is maybe, you know, and I'm sure there will be people who come back to this podcast and comment on it or whatever and say, I can reach my brakes just fine, and you know, maybe it is just a me thing, but that is at least my experience and the experience of a heck of a lot of other people who have asked, and so I'm not a fan of it. The other one trend I want to touch on there before we just close out the podcast was just crank length, which was something I did in one of the Flanders Roubaix or Flanders galleries, because I think that's another area that we're seeing to be beginning to see a bit of a shift, and at the moment it's still kind of absolutely seems almost random what you'll find, everything from actually maybe just one set of 175s across the entire peloton, and I didn't get to check all the bikes, but there certainly seem to be almost no 175 cranks anymore. 170s and 172s are still the most common, but we are starting to see outliers like Jack Bauer, who is over 1.90 meters tall on 170 cranks, which you probably wouldn't have seen a rider that tall running that short of cranks previously. Couple of riders on 165s, but I think, you know, we probably will see more of that in future as well. If we go around and check time trial bikes at the Tour, I'm sure you'll spot a few 155s and 160s. And much like you were saying about mountain biking earlier, sort of being ahead of the game, time trialing also tends to be that way. And I think we might see that feed into road racing going forward also. Because again, you know, I do think we're sort of maxing out the aero, for lack of a better term, of the frames, and riders are going to start looking for other ways, and popping on shorter cranks and getting your torso angle down lower is one way you can go about that.
Something to keep an eye on
without affecting your braking control.
which is not something we want to happen. Well, thanks, Ronan, for the deep rundown. There's a whole pile of galleries up on escapecollective.cc. Go check those out. There's more coming, I think, right?
Yes.
And lots of classics tech stuff from the last couple of weeks. So go check that out. Become a member if you aren't already. As we've said a million times, that's how we fund this entire operation. So please do go join. We very much appreciate it. Ronan, we'll be back next week, right? Another Geek Warning?
Yeah, not sure who's on next week's Geek Warning, but some of us will be back.
Somebody will be back. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.